Hey everybody, welcome to Required Reading. This week we are covering Mike Burns' selection for the book in high school he did not like, A Baffling Sea Tale by Herman Melville called Billy Budd. We appreciate you listening, we appreciate you tuning in, and we appreciate doing all that you do in order to help make us the, you know, the hit we are, the help us find new listeners, help us get shared around. With that in mind, please keep reviewing, keep sharing, and keep doing those things so more people can hear us in your ears. Next week, we do other Mike's pick, and we will do The Plague by Albert Camus. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Welcome to Required Reading. Happy April Fool's Day. we are continuing our, I guess, it's not really a month, it's three episodes in a row of books that we were assigned in high school and either didn't read or didn't like or were afraid of or shocked by or whatever. Things that we would not have come back to unless I came up with the idea to come back to them. Today we're talking Herman Melville's Billy Budd, which came out in, I think was written in the 1890s. I don't think it was finished when he died. Right. It was not published until a little bit later, right? So this was his last work.
Even he didn't finish it. Enough said.
All right, good.
That's all we need to say. Good night. Thank you very much.
Yes. And you can hear my first co-host. This is Mike Burns.
Hi, Mike. This is my book.
Mike Carroll.
Yeah.
Yeah, this was Mike. This is Mr. Burns' choice. So do you have a reasoning?
Well, I just remember, I was trying to think back. I think it was Mrs. Gregory at Lassiter High School. Hi, Francis, if you're out there. And I don't know why or how she assigned this, but it must have been, I think we took AMLIT my junior year. And so this was a required book, and I never read it, and which was unusual for me. I read everything. I would, you know, go home from school and just read to the expense of my other homework, like math and other stuff. I just never got into it. And then I trust my 16-year-old self. I had good sensibilities there. There's no reason to read this. There's no reason to foist this on a high school audience. And we can go into that, and I'd be glad to. But yeah, I didn't change my view. I wasn't won over. It's not a great work that grows with you as you age. It stunk then. It stinks now. That's it. I don't know what else to say.
I mean,
but I know, Mike, you feel differently.
So. Yeah, yeah.
I was going to say, I know you feel differently. It just, to me, this, it feels like a strange book because of the pacing at some points.
Yeah.
I am someone who's picked up Moby Dick more than once and then put it back down. When they get into the history of whaling for 200 pages,
right.
I don't get much past that. Compared to that, this is actually fairly brief. And when I was in high school, what we assigned was a short story. Bartleby the Scrivener.
Right.
And there's elements of that kind of here, like there's kind of whiffs of it. But yeah, this just to me, when I read that it was an incomplete work, I believe it because there's something about the polish that feels like, well, two different authors, which would make sense. So how about you, Mr. Carroll?
Yeah, so I know that I, on the panel here, am in the minority. I didn't love it, but I did like it. And I think that there are aspects of the text. Now, let me kind of take a step back and say that I think, Mike, had I encountered this when I was in high school originally, I, like you, think I would have despised it.
Right.
I think that a little bit later on, covering the story for this podcast, I think I don't know. I didn't hate it. I didn't hate it. I liked the allusions that were being made. I know that the allegory is kind of just slapping you across the face throughout the text, the kind of Christian allegory. I don't know. I will say that for the last couple of weeks, I've been talking with Catherine and I've been like, I'm so excited about the Billy Budd podcast because I knew that you guys were from having talked with you guys in the halls. I knew that you guys weren't super pleased with it, but, and believe me, I'm not trying to change your mind. I understand the criticisms, the digressions that you're talking about in Moby Dick into the whaling industry. They're abounding in Billy Budd. They're all over the place, these digressions, and I can't wait to get into them because it's almost kind of humorous in a way when Herman Melville is talking about, like, well, I apologize for this, but in order for you to really understand this story, you need to understand more about this totally different captain and admiral who was involved in the British Navy. And in order to really understand the story, I have to go into the background and historical makeup of the ship that Billy Budd was on. And it's almost kind of funny in just how severe those digressions are, but I don't know. I didn't mind it. I kind of like the allusions and the digressions, and the one thing that I will say is that the style and the tone is kind of shifty and difficult to pin down at times. But I guess I didn't find it as insufferable as you guys did.
Well, I'm gonna in your defense, Mike. You are a well-read, literate, intelligent reader. But there's no way you would teach this, right?
Oh, no, absolutely not.
Right.
No, so, and I think that's...
This is graduate school level stuff.
Yeah, and I think that that's
even
why...
Then, yeah.
That's why I kind of paused a little bit after saying that I didn't love it. I liked it, but I do understand why it is that encountering this in high school, you would have despised it as much as you did.
Right.
Because I would have hated this if I had read it in high school. I think I would have hated this if I encountered it in undergrad as well. Nick, like you, I read... Bartleby the Scrivener in college, my sophomore year of college, and that was my first and until this point my only real introduction into Melville. And there are definitely flashes of Bartleby in this, but I think more so, I don't think that it's almost like T.S. Eliot in its like layering of the allusions and the allegories that are chock full in this story and the references and the background. And I don't think that I wouldn't have liked it in high school. I don't think I would have liked it in undergrad. I don't know if I would have liked it in my master's. I think part of it is because we read it so closely after making our way through the behemoth Jane Eyre. And I think that it was kind of like shorter, and I don't know, for whatever reason, my encountering of the text, I was open to it, and I didn't mind it.
I will say, you said there's some hard things to nail down in this. I would include in that the plot.
Yeah.
But part of me wonders if you don't like this and the Melville style in the same way you like Beowulf, where they have to learn the history of all the kings before they can get to drinking.
Yeah.
And so, because that's also a book that's just filled with, like, oh, wait. To understand this, you've got to hear this story of the epic founding of the Danes, right?
Or this song that, like, references back, right? Yeah, no, there's definitely some overlap there with Beowulf, and I'm so glad anytime on this podcast that Beowulf comes up and I don't have to be the one that forces it and brings it up myself. So, yeah, I appreciate that.
The basic plot is good, and then I guess it's been a fairly successful adaptation as an opera, like a light opera. But yeah, just the prose is so tortured. I mean, let me read this sentence. I'm a couple paragraphs in. Now, while Billy Budd was down in the forecastle getting his kit together, the bell potent lieutenant, burly and bruff, nowise disconcerted by Captain Graveling's omitting to proffer the customary hospitalities on an occasion so unwelcome to him, an omission simply was caused by a preoccupation of thought, unceremoniously invited himself into the cabin, and also to a flask of the spirit locker, a receptacle which his experienced eye instantly discovered. Like, come on, man. Just like the guy saw a flask and took a drink. I mean, just like it's so like torturous is
it's
what
labored
I'm gonna say.
In its prose.
Yeah.
And I can hear it in your voice as
but
you're
to
reading
his
it.
I mean, yeah, the basic plotting, the symbolism of innocent Billy versus the experience and being corrupted by that and sacrificing himself. That I mean, I get the core of a good story is here, but just the how it is told. And And to be fair to Melville, maybe if had he had time to edit it before he died, it could be a very different thing.
That sentence would have been half as long.
Right, it should be half as long, and nobody's going to put up with that. So,
Certainly not a high school student, right? And I think that's part of the reason why we're kind of jumping ahead to oftentimes what we talk about at the end of the podcast and whether we would want to or whether we could see this being taught in the high school English classroom. And I think that we can, spoiler alert, I don't think that any of us are going to be an advocate for teaching this in the high school classroom.
And one other thing, which I definitely didn't get enough into as a high schooler to see or appreciate is just how homoerotic it is. Do we want to go there?
Yeah. It's so homoerotic.
Yeah.
I mean, from like the first,
right,
exactly. The very beginning.
I clearly
like
didn't get past the first two pages because it's there, which I don't know if we want to go into, but yeah, that was something
I didn't
expect going back into.
It's not long. It's all available on Wikisource, right? You can just find it. I was reading along and I stopped and I put on Twitter, required_pod. He was about to ejaculate something hasty at the sailor. And I was just like,
well, this is right after he goes by and taps him on the rear, too.
That's right.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of grab ass in this.
Yeah.
Okay. Before we really get into the plot, just quickly, I was going to ask you, too, you literate gentlemen, what is significant about Melville in the history of American literature? Because obviously Moby Dick, until Gatsby shows up, it's considered, it's up there. You know, it's Moby Dick, it's maybe Huck Finn as the greatest American novel.
Yeah, right? I'm the wrong guy to ask. I'll admit I have a Melville-sized hole in my curriculum. I've read some of his short stories. I've started Moby Dick several times, as you have said, Nick, but I've never finished it. So I can't speak to his reputation because... I mean, I know the name, and I know it's big, and people call it one of the greatest novels, American novels, but I've not read it, so I'll admit my ignorance there. And
yeah.
There's a sense of shame with that, I'll say that.
I think that it's almost, in some ways, maybe a lack of other writers during that time period. I mean, just kind of like trying to think back for what it is that you would put down as like the flagship work during Melville's time. There isn't really much else. I mean... I think circa this time you're getting some of like Whitman's poetry, but that's poetry. That's not
right. That's
not really kind of like a novel that would in any way, shape, or form try and encapsulate like American life at that time. So I think I almost wonder if it's more a lack of other options.
No competition.
for why it is that Melville is considered to be such a prominent writer. And correct me if I'm wrong, but he wasn't during his lifetime.
No, he was pretty much a failure.
Yeah,
right.
It was after his death only that he was considered to be the great writer that he was.
Right.
Yeah, I believe it. I mean, Moby Dick.
He's scraped by, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Moby Dick comes out, what, a decade before the Civil War, you know? And so, like, that changes everything. Like, he's coming out writing this kind of romantic stuff opposite Poe and the Transcendentalists. Like, you can't imagine something more different than the Transcendentalists than this. This is heavy prose. And then, like you said, what I saw was about a century. What would have been his, like, 100th birthday is when he starts getting a resurgence in, like, the early 20th century around World War One. I honestly, it does feel weird compared to some of his contemporaries where, you know, like you said, Hawthorne's around by this point.
He was a big Hawthorne fanboy. It was like, yeah. And Hawthorne apparently, like I said, didn't return that. He's like kind of kept his distance from Melville, but Melville was all about it. And there's a nice little allusion to the birthmark in here. He shouts out to the woman who had a stain or something like that. I've got the quote, but... yeah, so he sort of was an acolyte of Hawthorne, I guess you could say.
Although it's funny, if he is making it big, you know, like at the centenary, like the 1919, like that's right as Hemingway's short prose is about to take over. So you could, I mean, that's a sharp contrast right there.
Yeah.
And even Hawthorne, we did the Scarlet Letter in the first season. Like that is much more simplified. That's more layered, right? Like the language isn't difficult. I mean, compared to Hemingway, it's difficult. But... it's much more like makes many more allusions. Like there's much more weight to what they're saying, even though it's simpler text. So I don't know. It's just he's kind of a weird anathema to what's going on. Again, we've done Poe, and Poe is different. Like it's just it's so interesting to see how such writing styles can come out of the same kind of time period. So, Mr. Carroll, I see you're itching. You ready to give us a plot synopsis?
Well, no, there were a lot of thoughts that kind of were. Spiraling through my head there, but we were kind of, before I get into the plot, just one of the things we were just talking about there was kind of this notion of when Melville was writing, and this being such a late work, and in fact he died before ever finishing it, it's almost like there's like a death of romanticism that's very kind of like at work in this story, and you can see the like it's almost like a sacrifice to an emblem of romanticism with the character of Billy Budd. Spoiler alert: we haven't gotten into the plot, but he dies. But the there does seem to be almost a euphoria that kind of surrounds this notion of romanticism and beauty in the story, and it's almost kind of a bit of an elegy to this like missed notion of romanticism. And when you guys were talking about when it is that this story was written, anyways, that was just something that was kind of on the brain as we were making.
So Billy as an allegory for romanticism itself, just like this idealized
thing that dies,
or sacrificed.
Yeah, there's a reading there. I think I don't think that it's quite as strong as the Christian Christ allegory, but I think that with the transition from the rights of man into the very kind of like, I mean, the name itself, the bellipotent, the mm-hmm. war strong, or the strong in war ship. You get kind of this transition from what feels like the kind of like the putting of Nelson up on Captain Nelson up on this pedestal of, and he was, I mean, he was romanticism like to a T. He's got like all of the regalia, and he's got all of his medals and his awards that make him the perfect target for why it is that he dies in the battle with the French. But it does seem as though there's kind of this longing or missing of this notion of romanticism and a little bit of cynicism there that's gone. Yeah. And I think that that's perhaps historically where it is that Billy Budd fits, is this this reminiscing almost of romanticism that has passed.
I buy it, especially since his early writing is before the Civil War. And now he's writing during mass industrialization, right? Yeah. And so it's looking to a bygone era. And you're right, the allusion to Thomas Paine with one ship, you know, this warship, right? Mm-hmm. Warships are literally shoving it out of the way. Like, I think that's all there. You know, it's an interesting interpretation. Obviously, Melville, when I was reading this, I was thinking of those 1950s swashbuckling films, mm-hmm. right? Which in and of themselves are a throwback to a romantic era of kind of like, you know, masculinity and such, yep. and the Errol Flynn stuff. So, yeah, I mean, I see all of that. But it's in some ways to me, it suffers like you're reading the Silmarillion rather than Lord of the Rings.
Oh, yeah.
Because it spends so much time describing this world, and then the actual story itself is fairly brief. And, you know, again, like Lord of the Rings, it's mildly homoerotic. Yeah. So,
No, that
mildly? Come on, man. You're underselling that.
Yeah, I do actually, the Silmarillion comparison is pretty apt, because the just thinking about the digressions and the layering and the background that is provided into, all things considered, a relatively simple story. I think that it's that parallel is definitely there.
Yeah, you could take out a lot of the description and have the action and make allusions to what's mm-hmm. going on. Make it, instead of 150 pages, 60 pages, and you have a very nice kind of novelique or whatever something 60 pages would be, a part of a collection. Mm-hmm. But anyway, why don't you tell us what actually happens?
So we'll get into it. Speaking of homoeroticism, the start of the story begins with kind of an introduction to a handsome black sailor that's given pretty strong detail, I guess you could say. And it's kind of a parallel just right out of the gate to what will be the main character in the story, Billy Budd, and his beauty and his handsome character. And the description of the black sailor is such that he is kind of like the leader through both his appearance and also through his his leadership qualities, that all the other men look up to him. And then kind of cut scene into Billy Budd. Billy Budd was an orphan, a foundling from Bristol. He was handsome, just like the handsome black sailor was. He has a stutter. And he originally was a sailor on the Rights of Man, which is a reference to Thomas Paine, I believe, mm-hmm. history aficionado. So Rights of Man was a merchant ship that he was on. And then he was enlisted to be a sailor, asked to be a sailor on the Bellipotent, which is a warship in the British Navy.
Not really asked, right? Wasn't he sort of conscripted?
Kind of like enlisted. It was like a request that carried with it, I think, like a rise in rank as well. But it was, I don't know. I was
didn't
like
really have a choice, Nick, right? He was conscripted.
That's the way I interpreted it, that he was forced, but he was promised that he would be given a good place on the ship.
Yeah.
But I don't think he had the option to say no.
He goes fairly willingly.
He's conscribed.
That's part of his naivete is how I read that.
I think part of my confusion was, I think it was Ratcliffe was the character that was either enlisting him or whatever the process was by which these sailors on these ships were forced to be there. But it seemed like the description was that Ratcliffe was really happy when he agreed to be on the ship, whereas his previous captain, can't remember the name of the previous captain on the Rights of Man, was quite disappointed that he had joined the ranks.
Oh, you picked my best player.
Exactly,
my best guy.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. I was a little bit admittedly confused as to the situation in which Billy Budd ended up on the Bilipotent, but nevertheless, he ends up there on this ship where we are introduced to Claggart, who is, I didn't write down the name of his role on the ship, but he was, he ends up not taking a liking to Billy.
Master at Arms,
yeah,
right?
That's exactly what it was, Master of Arms. And he doesn't like Billy. It's lent, the description is that he was envious of Billy, that obviously Billy was a handsome character, and not that Claggart wasn't, but he was described as being envious, and that vice of envy is really talked down by Melville during the descriptions that you get of Claggart. Like many of the other characters, the captain himself, Captain Vier, who we'll get into in a little bit, Claggart, you get a digression when you encounter Claggart, so you get a little bit of his backstory and where it is that he comes from, but nevertheless he ends up charging Billy with inciting a mutiny. So he brings this charge to Captain Vier, and Captain Vier likes Billy. He thinks that he's a well-liked, seems like he's a hard enough working, kind of run-of-the-mill, can't ever see a world in which Billy would do something of this nature, but nevertheless brings Billy into his captain's quarters to kind of figure out what's going on here. And he, with both of the men in his quarters, talks with Claggart, talks with Billy about what it is that Claggart is charging Billy with. And Billy is kind of like dumbfounded, and due to his stutter, isn't really able to defend himself and isn't able to piece together the words that would allow for him to defend himself.
And the charge is completely made up.
Yes,
right?
Yes, it is.
It's very important, yeah.
Yeah, so he is innocent of any sort of like mutineering that might have otherwise transpired. And in an act of rage, I guess you could say, ends up punching Claggart and killing Claggart. He strikes Claggart and ends up killing Claggart. And that is kind of the crime that then the rest of the story ends up trying to morally get to the bottom of what it is that happened there. And I guess we can kind of stop there for a second and kind of debrief some of what it is that's unfolded so far.
Sure. I will say I haven't seen this. There's a Peter Ustinov version that's supposed to be pretty good.
Terrence Stamp, right?
Terrence Stamp, that's right. The one everyone recommends. Although I will say, apparently in 1955, the General Motors Theater made a version starring William Shatner as Billy Budd and Basil Rathbone as the captain. And apparently it was
there's your next Cineprov.
I was going to say, I can't find it, but it's an hour-long TV version. And apparently in the first 30 seconds as he walks on stage, Basil Rathbone gets his foot stuck in a bucket on stage. And so he immediately throws off the timing of the whole thing. And Shatner's like 23 at the time.
Wow. That'd be something to see.
Young Shatner, yeah.
Yeah. But so what you've described, of course, cuts out all of the side notes, which
yes.
we get to. Because... again, if you go up to like Wikisource, the first chapter is like four times longer than everything else because obviously that's probably what he spent was on the third or fourth draft of, and everything else was being fleshed out. But yeah, you get this feeling that Billy Budd, on one hand, as Mr. Burns pointed out, Mike pointed out, he's forced onto the ship, but he has this kind of happy-go-luckiness about him, which is his endearing quality.
That like a
he
little
wants
puppy,
to do.
Yeah,
exactly. And he wants people to like him. And the fact that
they do, they love him.
Yeah.
He's the little mascot.
Yeah.
And the fact that someone doesn't, like, he not only doesn't see coming, but it immediately is his downfall because he assumes the best in everyone, mm-hmm. which I imagine is Melville as himself, like, editors just don't understand me. I want it to be so good. Like, I don't know what it is. It's just, it's such a naive character, which, again, compared to the other stuff I've read by him, everyone is very hardened. Billy Budd is a very weird character, and Bartleby the Scrivener, like, everyone is so put upon. Bartleby is a very distinct character. Even in What a Run of Moby Dick, it's, you know, Ishmael is not exactly naive. He's not a waif. Yeah. Like, so this character coming on, like, he's in a musical. When you said it was an opera, I'm like, of course it's an opera, because he comes in practically with a song
right. yeah.
in this story. It's really quite something.
Yeah, I think he's such an interesting character to create a Christ allegory with.
Uh-huh.
And because he does seem so naive, and he does seem so aloof, and does seem so almost unintentional in his way of going about things. And so it's almost, he's like a Christ figure, almost like by default or by definition, but doesn't even know it. So it is an interesting character to have be such a prominent in the world of literature. It's an interesting character to have as a Christ figure, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when he goes to that meeting, he thinks, "Oh, I'm going to get a promotion," or he sort of walks in thinking, "Oh, I've done a good job," and then, ends up never coming out of that room again.
Yeah.
Or onto his death.
And I guess
go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, no, I was just gonna say we can if you guys don't have anything else to add, we can kind of keep marching our way through.
Well, I mean, I was just gonna add, like, you mentioned a lot of the allusions here, a lot of the stuff. The one thing that I think Melville really does a good job of is describing 19th century, sailing. Mm-hmm. And something that I tried to instill this year, and it has a lot to do with some books I've read by Marcus Rediker, sailor's life was terrible. Like, and again, like, even on the book I was referring to is The Slave Ship by Marcus Rediker. It came out a few years ago. But he was just kind of talking about the cruelty of the sailors to the slaves and then the cruelty against them. Like, they had no say in anything.
Yeah.
And so to have such a happy-good-lucky character feels, again, like you've entered this romantic Errol Flynn movie rather than reality. But the reality is all around him, which is kind of interesting. And as his former ship sails away, the Rights of Man, and he says, "And goodbye to you, Rights of Man," as though he's literally saying, "Well, I'm screwed." Which, again, I think Melville understood this world. He grew up in, I believe, Massachusetts, right? And he watched these ships. And he wrote Moby Dick because that was the world around him constantly. And so I get that. And I feel like here, as much as it is, you know, a world that's changing, and, you know, now merchant marines are there instead of these rough and tumble men who go for months, often years at sea for whaling. There's this disconnect between the land and the people, and this romanticized version has to go somewhere to die.
Is it the Churchill line that the British Royal Navy was run by three things: rum, sodomy, and the lash?
Yeah.
That's quite the line.
Yeah, well, it's a great line, yeah. But just like to really contrast the complete innocence of Billy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
These are hardened, salty sea dogs, and he's like Adam before the fall. He describes him at one point.
Yeah, that's.
But he also mentions Adam before the fall in the nude. Just sort of like slipping in these little weird homoerotic, but maybe that goes to the point of the sodomy and the rum sodomy and the lash. I don't know.
No, you're fine. It's like having a Disney character show up in the middle of drama.
A Quentin Tarantino film or something, or David Cronenberg or something really dark
and Muppets
weird.
The Muppets do Amistad. Like, it doesn't fit. Which makes it compelling. And I can understand why, if you were someone in the 1950s during the Cold War and you were looking for these kind of compelling one-off characters, it's a compelling character. It's just, it does feel very weird, especially compared to some of the people we've talked about recently in our books.
Well, I think that another story that we had talked about earlier on in this podcast is The Birthmark, right? And I think that in this story, in Billy Budd, it seems like you have a romanticized, like, almost almost to a fault, definitely to a fault, character in Billy Budd, who's in this like industrial world. And so it's almost like you get a character that's transplanted from one world into the other. Another story that we see that in is The Birthmark, right? We get the it's a romanticized and romantic world, and I'm forgetting the name of the scientist from The Birthmark, you guys. I didn't teach it this year, so you guys might well,
oh, geez, I should know
might
this.
Well remember more than I do. But anyways, he's like he's a
Almer
yeah. is a is like an Enlightenment character who's almost stuck in like a romanticized story. So it's almost kind of like the flip flop of that. But
yeah, there's a quote I just have. This is where he alludes to Hawthorne. Though our handsome sailor had as much of masculine beauty as one can expect anywhere to see, nevertheless, like the beautiful woman in one of Hawthorne's minor tales, there was just one thing amiss in him.
Yeah.
So it's just a shout out.
There you go. Yeah, I think that it's in a so is it Georgiana? Is that the name of the
right.
the beautiful woman in, mm-hmm. who is like similarly this emblem of romanticism? She has a flower that is the one blemish that that's upon her cheek, but she also seems as though she's this kind of emblem of romanticism. So I think that that's something that I came into the podcast kind of thinking was Billy Budd's kind of association with romanticism. And the more that I talk about it, the more I'm kind of convinced of it.
It's interesting how much time we've spent a century ago in this season just alone.
Yeah.
But this book obviously came out about 30 years after it was written. But 3 years after it's published, 1924 to 1927, is when Death Comes for the Archbishop comes out. And again, mm-hmm. I can't imagine a more different writing style than Willa Cather, which feels very thin, but it's about the vastness. But it's fairly simple sentences. It's clearly read as Hemingway. I also feel like she read this too and said, absolutely not. Right?
Going the other direction.
Yeah. It's just, American literature at the time was kind of all over the place, but you can see them experimenting with the novel as an art form. So it's interesting to see that someone who's, I think, doing a biography of Melville comes across this and goes, America's ready for this now, which is just interesting.
Yeah, and to your point about The Birthmark, I just read later in that paragraph, Billy's fatal flaw is his stutter, which leads to his death, not unlike Georgiana. Mm-hmm. Her birthmark, the little hand, leads to her death.
It's an interesting hamartia to have for a character like Billy.
And it made me think as a reader, and I never thought this before, but have you guys read One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
I'm not.
Okay, so the Billy Bibbit character in that.
Also
just the
stutters.
Alliteration. He also stutters. He's very innocent, ends up dying. Well, he commits suicide. But that, I wondered if Ken Kesey was sort of riffing on that. I don't know. Just
well, I mean, and he's it's also a society built up to destroy something that's young, innocent, and unable to speak for themselves, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I can see that. Yeah,
who knows?
See, this contains multitudes.
Well, it certainly does that, all in one sentence as well.
Sure.
Anyways, we can. I think we
Please.
Should try and polish off the plot here. So we get Captain Vere, who now has his Master of Arms, who is now deceased, in his captain's quarters, and needs to figure out what it is that he's going to do. His name, Vere, with the root of veritas, looking for truth, I think is another one of kind of those layers. And then
also severe, like you can riff on severe. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And to veer is to go away from the original.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a lot going on with names in this story, actually. But the Captain Veer needs to kind of decide what it is that's going to happen. He brings in I don't know how to describe this character, and I don't have the name written down. I don't know if we even get a name for the character who comes in and is kind of like the naval attorney who's trying to kind of like help with the philosophy of what it is that we're supposed to do with Billy Budd. But he doesn't seem very helpful. And I think that what ends up happening is Captain Vere needs to kind of decide for himself what it is that he's going to
do.
Well,
he's the judge and the only witness,
yeah,
too. So, right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, and in order to kind of jump to the verdict that he comes to, in order to not have any perceived ripplings of mutiny that could weaken the entire Navy at large, he says that that Billy needs to be hanged. He needs to be put to death.
The angel must hang.
Yeah, the angel must hang is the line that's used. And so that is kind of like the sentencing. And then in a really strange moment, we don't get to see, we are privy to so much information from our mysterious narrator in this story, but we don't get to see the last conversation between Captain Veer and Billy Budd. It happens behind closed doors so strangely. We know the background of like the wood that made the ship that these characters are on, and we can't see the conversation that's taking place there behind those closed doors. But you do get kind of like a Garden of Gethsemane type of a last moment, Last Supper kind of a moment behind closed doors for Billy, between him and the captain. And he walks out of that room kind of like a condemned dead man. And then they hang Billy Budd. And his last words are, "God bless Captain Veer," which is such an interesting line. Again, I know I'm kind of layering in the Christian Christ allegory here, but it's just so reminiscent of, "Forgive them, Lord, they know not what they do."
Right.
Right? So it's almost the still God blessing the executioner here in
and all the sailors echo that back, right?
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. In kind of this kind of forlorn, but also almost kind of like haunting way. So anyways, Billy Budd dies, and then we get kind of a strange ending to the story. That ends the plot, and then as strangely as it starts, we kind of make our way out of the plot as well. Captain Veer, we get a little bit about how Captain Veer dies.
Right.
He dies in combat with a French ship. Again, names being so significant, the Athea or the
Atheist.
The name of the ship in French is the Atheist, which I think has some implications over the kind of that transition from Romanticism into the Industrial
Revolution.
Age and
the French Revolution.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'll stop you there because I have the line pulled up.
Yeah.
"Not long before death, while lying under the influence of that magical drug which, soothing the physical frame, mysteriously operates on the subtler element in man, he was heard to murmur words inexplicable to his attendant, 'Billy Budd, Billy Budd.' That these were not the accents of remorse would seem clear from what the attendant said to the indomitable senior officer of Marines, who, as the most reluctant to condemn the members of the drumhead court, too well knew. Though here he kept the knowledge to himself who Billy Budd was."
Yeah. So maybe to take this, Mike, I know you've used the phrase homoeroticism a couple of times here. The last words off of the lips of Billy Budd are about Captain Veer, and the last words off of Captain Veer's lips are about Billy Budd. There's certainly kind of a almost modern take on romance that's going on there. But
well, it's a triangle too, because right. Claggart had a fixation with Billy as well, right?
Yeah. Right. So anyway, so we have not only the death of Billy Budd, but then the death of Captain Veer. And then we get the weird article that kind of misrepresents everything that had happened on the ship. And that's a strange kind of like legendary moment where now Billy Budd, Billy Budd is described as like a ruthless foreigner. He's described as stabbing rather than punching Claggart. And he's there were a couple of other kind of like misrepresentations. He was described as actually being guilty of a mutiny. And so the way that the article is brought about and the way that the article portrays this story, which is so different from the way that the narrator has described it up until that point, totally flips on its head what it is that has happened at sea. And it's all kind of in the name of making sure that everything is fine upon the HMS Bella Potent, right?
Right.
So it's almost kind of like showing that no, that was just one wild mutineer. There's nothing wrong here, nothing to see. And it kind of like almost pulls the wool over the eyes of the rest of the world, but not the reader, because the reader's been privy to the rest of the story leading up to that point. So it's kind of a misrepresentation of what it is that's happened throughout the story. And then just to close off the story here, we get kind of the song that's used as the elegy, the Billy and the Danby song that comes at the end of the story, which is it portrays Billy in a different way than he was portrayed throughout the story. He's described as being like very experienced, and we definitely get the death of the character and the sinking of the character's body, but it's a strange I would argue, misrepresentation of Billy as well in this song that's sung at the end of the story. And that kind of closes off the plot for us.
Yeah, it's very strange. And that last little bit, too, also has like a dig at Dr. Samuel Johnson for some reason.
Yeah.
It's strange. Also, just a note to those of you who try to read it and think he's insane. Some versions have it as the HMS Indomitable. And I think the version I read, too, is Bella Potent. Just something I looked up.
Oh, is that really? Oh.
Because apparently in his original draft, it was called The Indomitable. Huh. And then the first published version called it The Bella Potent. And then, I mean, PhDs in literature, man. Someone back and changed it. And The Indomitable would have fit even more with your allegory.
I know. I'm thinking back here, and I wish that the version that I had read had been The Indomitable. I think that that's maybe it would have been hitting you over the head too much, and he wanted something a little bit more subtle. But.
Well, and again, just this is chapter 29. The criminal paid for the penalty of his crime. The promptitude of the punishment has proved salutary. Nothing amiss is now apprehended above the HMS Indomitable. Has so much more of a punch. Nothing amiss above the Indomitable. Is just, I mean, it's practically like Seussian in its like convoluted nature, which great.
Yeah.
I had read, maybe you guys can back this up, that Melville wrote the Billy and the Darbys first and then was sort of like, oh, I'm going to spin out and tell the backstory. And that's how the genesis of all this.
Hobbit before Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what I was thinking. Yeah, that's really interesting.
Oh, I believe it.
So it's interesting. He starts with a story and then goes back and tells a very different backstory.
I will say, too, though, apparently in his later life, because, again, this is after the war. This is 40 years after he was writing this 40 years after Moby Dick. He apparently had written a bunch of poetry, maybe inspired by the Transcendentalists or whatever. And so it makes sense that he writes something akin to a song and a short story and like almost an epic tale, like he's writing a revenge kind of poem, and now he wrote this longer story back to form kind of thing. Very interesting. So, Mike, what do you think?
To quote Melville, I prefer not to.
Yeah.
Shout out to the Bartleby, right. Bartleby fans Scooter. Out there.
No, I mean, I get it, and Mike, you did a good reading of it, and I think that's a fair interpretation, but I think just it's so dense, it needs a let's give Melville the benefit of the doubt. I don't want to be anti-intellectual at all, that it needs a better editor. Core, the kernel of the story could be good and the allegories and all that, but just it's too convoluted to get there, I think, for a modern reader, certainly a modern high schooler. No one's going to put up with this. Yeah.
It's almost kind of a tale of what could have been if there were to have been more edits done to the story. And, of course, this story not being finished when he died, I think, it's not his fault, but right. I think that you're right. What we're left with is a tale that needed some editing down. This is not in an attempt to try and sway you guys, but I did have the rainbow quote that was used in here. That it's probably one of the more famous quotes that I think kind of gets at some of that romanticism, and the sentences aren't as this is from chapter 21, so I think it's lost some of those. Some of those verbose kind of tone and intonations that Mike, you were reading the quote before, but this is from the very start, the very first paragraph of chapter 21. And it's on the notion of kind of sanity and insanity. And this was one of them that kind of stopped me in my tracks as I was going through it. And it says this: who in the rainbow can draw the line where the violet tint ends and the orange tint begins? Distinctly, we see the difference of the colors. But where exactly does the one first blendingly enter into the other? So with sanity and insanity. In pronounced cases, there is no question about them. But in some supposed cases, in various degrees, supposedly less pronounced, to draw the exact line of demarcation, few will undertake, though for a fee, some professional experts will. There is nothing nameable but the sum... but that some men will undertake to do it for pay. So we get this line here. It is kind of like biting in its kind of anti-capitalism towards the end of the quote, but just the beginning of the quote being this metaphor that's created, this extended metaphor for where it is that sanity begins and insanity, where it is that line falls and the indistinguishability of kind of right and wrong and good and evil and sanity and insanity, I think is just really romantically defined there. And I think that there are passages like that, that in the midst of some trudgery, for lack of a better word, throughout this story, I think that there are kind of like these little snippets that kind of like caught my attention, even in the style of the prose that I know that you guys were so often put off by. But yeah, anyways, kind of in summary for kind of how it is that I feel about the text, I liked it. Would not recommend teaching it to high school students. But there's a layering here, and maybe Nick, maybe you're onto something with my profound love of Beowulf and some of the structure that's kind of akin to it.
You
here.
Like to go deep, Mike. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
But I don't know. I didn't mind it as much as you guys did. I obviously can hear all of where it is that you guys are coming from, but I didn't mind it. Would not recommend teaching it.
I will just add, I didn't hate it. In fact, I like talking about it more than anything. I think where this would fit is if you were doing like a graduate course of American literature and you needed something from him to talk about the late 19th century. Because yeah. I think it's a good contrast to what else is coming out at the time. You know, this is after Twain has passed. This is after a lot of the Transcendentalists are passed, if not on the way out, right? Like this is 1891. It's a new America that's coming into the world stage, and we have different literature on the horizon after World War I. So it's an interesting way to get to it, because you can't do Moby Dick, which is 600 pages, when you're comparing it to other things the same week. Mm-hmm. I will also add, just because this tickled me to no end, based on some of the interpretations, especially Mr. Burns had, in 2002, it was adapted to a radio drama by Focus on the Family.
Really?
I guess they got different
Christ
things
imagery,
out of it.
Yeah.
They focused more on Carroll's interpretation than on the homoeroticism.
Right.
Before we get out of here, Mr. Carroll, can you tell us what your selection is for this little traipse through our literary past?
Yes. We will be reading for our next work that we hated from high school, my selection, which is Albert Camus' The Plague. So I hated it when I was in high school, and I can only hope that in revisiting it for this podcast, I have some glimmer, some takeaway. I'm doubtful, but I'm hoping that maybe at least after talking about it with you guys, I'll fall more under Nick's side after having read Jane Eyre than Mike's side here after reading Billy Budd.
Yeah, I will say I tried.
Did you read it all in high school, Mike?
I did. I did read it when I was in high school.
I gave up on Billy Budd in high school. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I will say it's quite the trifecta, because you did an English or an American book. I did an English book. We have a French book.
Yep.
I read The Stranger in high school, mm-hmm. and I picked up, because I have a dark sense of humor, I picked up The Plague during COVID, and I was like, I'm not that funny, and I put it back. So we'll be interested to see how it goes. But we're telling you now, because it's short enough, you could pick it up and just read it before we get there. It's only a couple hundred pages, maybe 150. Mm-hmm. Thanks for listening. Thanks for subscribing. Thanks for doing all you do to make this podcast the hit that it is. And if you haven't yet, review it. Share it with someone new, because we really do appreciate it when you do that, because it brings more attention to the show.
And it'd be cool. Tweet back to us. Let us know what your hated books were. I'd be interested to see what the sort of span of that is and what sins as a teacher I've foisted on students.
No kid. Actually, that
would
be
interesting. Kids are cursing themselves now. Like, oh, yeah. Mr. Burns made me read Scarlet Letter.
That's right. That's actually a good idea. Send us some recommendations either to my Twitter, which is required_pod, or to Mike's Instagram.
Yeah, unless it's Beowulf. Don't send it.
That's right. But it might be something we can schedule for next season. Thanks, everyone.
Required Reading is a product of Maris Podcasting and Dude Letter Podcasting. It is hosted by Nick Hoffman and co-hosted by Mike Burns and Mike Carroll. It is edited and produced by Nick Hoffman. The theme is Sands by Davis Burns. The opinions expressed are opinions of the hosts and the guests, but not of Marist School. All rights reserved. Thanks.